Maybe this is true for other bands. I'm not sure, to be honest with you. But we have made autobiographical music since the beginning. You could look at any individual record that we made, and it's a pretty easy snapshot of what we loved about music and what we thought and believed and how we loved individually as people around the time we made it. And that's not the only way to make music, but it's the way that we have. And so it's like snatching a page of journal from the era of like 2011, 2012, 2014, 2016, 2018, 2020. Like everything that we've been releasing, including the cover songs we choose. Like, what are you into then? The desire to be prolific and the desire to be ever-changing has been there since the start. And that's been pretty fun. If you set at the very start of making a creative endeavor one of your totems as malleability, that's pretty cool because it helps you not pin yourself down too long. You can try any number of things. Like, that's one of the reasons why Kyle and I have always traveled for the most part. Not always. We travel with just he and I and a tour manager. So on stage, it's the skeleton of every song is me and him and a guitar. And then you can dress it up a thousand ways. It can wear so many different costumes and be fine. We've traveled with a string trio before. We've traveled with a country setup, stand-up bass and a fiddle. We've traveled with lap steel. I've played bass on stage. We've traveled with a couple of electric guitars. It has been malleable from the outset, which has made the creative process fun because we get to work with so many different people and try so many different genres, sometimes in the same song.
Wow. So do you just follow the muse? Just kind of whatever you're feeling, or is it like...
Certainly more in the beginning. We did that, and I say that because maybe that's just what we called it. Like, we called it, like, yeah, creativity is striking. We're excited about making this band, and the longer that we've done it, we've gotten to, I mean, I think the sheer length of career means there's going to be dry spells where you literally get to log in, like you get to clock in and do creative work, showing up whether the muse shows up that day or not.
Yep.
Which is, A, not easy, but... I think I value more than I used to. I know clocking in, doing creative work instead of waiting for there to be some lightning in a bottle creative moment.
And how does that show up for you? Like, is it like a daily practice, or what does that look like?
Show up and you read. I read every day. I write every day. And that may mean that all I could muster was one usable sentence, or it might mean that I mustered, 10,000 words of a short story, or not 10,000, like 1,000 words in a short story, or whatever. Or it could mean that I tried 8 different verse options out for a song, and none of them were good, and they're all trash. But I showed up and sat down.
Does it matter if it doesn't have like an end product in mind, or if you're like, I know this has nothing to do with my music, but this is what I want to write. Like, do you just write?
Sometimes.
Or does it have to have, do you kind of have that intention to make it musical?
I think I have the before I sit down to write, I have the intention of what I'm going to at least start with.
Gotcha.
So, like, I'm going to start working on music. And then if that meanders into like my brain wants to go toward short storying, or I've beat my head against the wall with music for 2 hours, 3 hours, and I don't feel like I'm getting any further, pushing the ball uphill, then I'll switch avenues. Try short story, try poetry, try free form sentence working, try essay stuff. And so, like, that seems exactly what it is, at times aimless. Just trying to say, show up, work on the craft. The craft being learning words, harvesting words, so that you can use as much of the English language as possible.
Whoa.
It's a big, big language, man. Big. It's really pretty, and I think it's at least in my, I don't know about my generation. I feel like the word bank that musicians are using, it runs the risk of getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And so the only way that I know to fight against that personally is to read a bunch and try and harvest as many words as I can, which I love that part of my job. Might be my favorite part of my job.
So are you the main lyrical contributor to Penny and Sparrow?
Mm-hmm. It's a symbiotic relationship for sure. He's 99% of the melody and I'm 99% of the lyrics. And there's definite crossover when we edit together. But in the beginning melodic idea, the beginning lyrical idea is almost all him and almost all me in our respective camps. He'll send me a roughly fleshed out melody via voice memo on his phone, and he'll text it to me, and it's him singing a melody on oohs and ahs or nonsensical gibberish. And then I take that, put it on a sheet of paper, cut it up, splice it so that I know exactly how many syllables I have in the chorus or in the verse or in the bridge to communicate an emotional idea that I drew from what he sent me, which is just noise, just melody, no words. And then I get to play Mad Libs. I literally get to, it's a creative writing assignment every single time. So I get to chop up what he sent, which is oftentimes super weird sounding and awesome, but rhythmic and my best friend's singing voice doing syllables. And then I get to make words.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah, it is fun.
So does he ever like push back on your lyrics?
Totally. Totally. And I'll push back on melody. And that's the 1% overlap, which is more than 1% at the end of the day, because we do it all the time. But the idea of saying, hey, I'd rather go up at the end of this phrase, or hey, here's a run idea that I came up with at the end of this phrase that you didn't do, is slightly different than the one you did. What do you think? And either agree or disagree, hash it out, discuss. But the cake being made, I get to decorate it.
Mm.
And that's really, really fun. And vice versa. Like, if he comes back at the end and is like, hey, I actually hate that word. It sounds gross to sing. I don't like it. Let's not do it. But for the most part, which is pretty great with the relationship Kyle and I have, I like what he does. He impresses the fuck out of me all the time. Like, he will send me things that I have no idea. It's like conjurer's tricks. I have no idea how he creates melody out of thin air. At least with my job, it seems like I've got a finite resource. Like, I've got the... I look on my shelf and I'm like, oh, that's where I got those from. So those are where those words are from. With melodic idea, I have no idea how they do it. It's magic to me.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas word collection, I'm like, oh, I just have a good memory for words. And I like it and it sounds pretty.
So where did your... you talked about where your music came from. What about your love of like of language, or you know, thinking about you know emotionally or whatever? Like, where did that come from?
It's tough to separate the two, I think, because I loved as early as I loved music, I loved what they were saying too. Like, I would memorize. You remember those infomercials when we were kids and how you'd wake up on Saturday mornings or late at night, they would show like compilation albums you could buy. Like, yes. 60 box set CDs of the greatest hits of the 50s and 60s.
Yes.
I would sit down and watch those over and over and over again, because after the 50s or the 60s, they would come in with the disco era. And after the disco era, it'd be like hair metal. And after hair metal was like Lilith Fair, the box set. And after Lilith Fair, it would be like Kurt Cobain and all the rock and roll from the post-grunge, like all that stuff. So you would watch these over and over and over and over and over again. And so I knew all the hooks to all of these songs from all these eras, and I was fascinated by them. Because they would play, if you remember they'd have that scrolling list of all the song titles, and they would highlight one of them as it went up. And then they would play like a quick piece of the music video or of them playing on Johnny Carson or whatever. And so I would memorize those hooks and I would think, like, this shit is amazing. Like, this, I didn't say shit because I was like 7 and 8, but I remember specifically thinking, this is awesome. I love this so much. And I didn't know what it was that I loved about it in the way that a kid just likes a thing and doesn't make sense of his reasoning or logic. But I just remember thinking, I could do this for the rest of my life. And just appreciate. And so I just binge and memorize it. And I knew who sang certain songs on the radio and it came up in the car because I'd seen all these commercials. And I'd wake up really early and they were always on TV and I would just tune to those stations and watch them. And so pretty early, I remember liking words and liking story and liking narrative and that idea being fused with music from a really early age, but not really being able to put together why I dug it. I just always have. Part of it's escapism, I'm sure, because I love story. I make parasocial relationships really quick with book characters, which is fun. I like.
What does that mean?
You cry when a character dies that doesn't really exist.
Oh yeah, okay.
Like you form this attachment where you literally give a shit that Cedric Diggory passes away at the end of book 4, thus heralding the turn of darkness into the world of Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And so like you do this thing, and some people don't do it. Some people read books and they're like, that's just not, they don't emotionally go there with a fictional character. And some people do. And from as early as I can remember, I always did. Whether it was a musical or it was a short story or it was, I just cared about that stuff and liked it.
So, not everyone is aware of their emotions, like on a hyper level, I guess. But it seems like just from what I've listened to of y'all's music, like, that's kind of part of your job. Like, did that come, like, through your raisin? Or did you have a lot of therapy? Like, how did that come about?
I think I know the answer to this one. I'll work backwards. It's not from therapy. My first therapy experience.
I think most people it is from therapy.
Sure, but I mean, I say all that to say, like, my first therapy session was 4 months ago. So I've been in therapy for 4 months and fucking love it. I'm obsessed now. Like this era is, I wanted to get in it before this era. And so I started, my first few meetings were in person and then COVID hit and I'm like, well, shit. And then my therapist is like, hey, we can still meet. We're just going to meet through Zoom. And so we just did that and transitioned. But I came into therapy with a huge desire and a bunch of years of experience talking feelings out. Granted, with pretty aimless language and not knowing how to do it really well, but always wanting to. And my best guess is that's a leavover from what began with talking to my mom and having candid conversations with her and transcended into Christianity, which was a huge part of my life for a big chunk of my life. And at least in the breed of Christendom that I was reared in, it was... emotion wasn't avoided. I mean, I grew up in the small group era. Small group era is of Christianity. It was like, hey, let's all get in the circle and talk about, you know, not only the Bible, but why you feel what you feel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
And although most may be unfair. How do I say this? Although a lot of that shit I have left, that is a thing that I'm so glad that I experienced. That I kept and I've held on to and I use all the time. The idea to be unafraid of talking about why you feel what you feel and being like giving a shit why someone else feels the way they feel, because that is tied directly with how you love yourself and other people. And that's another thing that stuck. So for those two things, I'm extremely, extremely grateful.
Mm.
But that was the crock pot that I learned all that shit in, was Christianity.
Cool.
Sometimes it was.
Yeah. No, I was there when the doors were open every time too.
Yeah.
And I've left a lot of that behind as well. But I think at my core, like, it very much informs like who I am as a human.
Yeah.
So we were like listening to some of y'all's music the other day. And Susan asked if y'all were a Christian band.
Sure.
And I was like, I don't know. But I like threw out, I told her like what my thoughts on that would be as a guess. You sure. Know? But I wasn't going to ask you.
I'm incredibly curious.
Like after... some of what you said, like, I figured I may as well.
Sure.
Or what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. Like I told you earlier, like, we've written autobiographical music, so the era of life that we wrote, Creature, the EP, the first thing that we released, I feel like we wore faith on our sleeve pretty openly. We would have said at the very, very beginning of career, we are not a Christian band. We are Christians who make music. That's not me anymore. I wouldn't identify with that statement any longer. I don't know what I am now. Like in a world, it's so funny for a person who is obsessed with words and finds myself pretty hungry for understanding and truth and having conversations like this. Like no part of a conversation like this makes me uncomfortable ever. I love having them because I see it as value. Early on, we would have considered ourselves Christian men who make music. And then, I don't know how this happened. I mean, life comes at you. You meet people who don't eat, dress, think, talk, fuck like you do. And so once you have that life experience, all of a sudden you're faced with the option of either looking at what you believe based on this new information, these new people, these new things, and either changing, staying the same, changing a little. To what degree do you change? What do you change? And how much of that do you communicate through art? And so what we've essentially done is we have lived, changed a lot, and throughout every single iteration and gradient of ourselves, we've been making albums the whole time. So you can look at what we think and what we believe predicated upon, or at least me lyrically, a lot through these songs, which becomes really, really funny when all of a sudden you're a different person at album 5, but someone thinks that you're the same human and expects you to be the same human, whether it be socially or theologically, from album 1 or song 1. That's a weird thing. Like all of a sudden we've got these emails because I sang fuck in a song that said, "You've scandalized my child." We bought your album and put it on, and we've done that with other albums, and then all of a sudden we hear this word, and how dare you? And you have to have this moment inside of yourself where you, first of all, you have to be comfortable with what you put on a thing. Second of all, you have to, at least in that instance, you have to look at somebody else and be like, you're assuming that the only good art is that which you can listen to right next to your baby daughter. You're assuming that the rubric, the grand rubric for that which is good art, is that which can be past your moral compass, which I think is a fallacy. Like, that's a thinking error in a major way. But I hate it when people sidestep really good direct interview questions, so I'll go back to exactly what you said.
I don't even remember what I asked anymore.
I think I ascribe right now to a theology of shrug, man. Maybe. There's a lot of really big, beautiful maybes. I believe in creatively loving people. I believe in so much of the tenets of Jesus and how he loved and how he lived. I have no idea about the world of the supernatural right now. I have no idea what I think about it or where I land on that. There is an ineffable quality about all things bigger than me, and I'm totally fine with it. So it's landed me on a maybe big, smiling, huge shrug.
What's ineffable mean?
Unknowable. Like, it's okay, it's so big and so complex. Like, it's almost like the doxology, if you know it. Oh, how great the wisdom, the knowledge of the God, how unsearchable are your ways beyond finding out. Like, it's, to me, it almost feels like Paul was saying something like that. Almost like looking at the cosmos and saying, you're ineffable. I don't get it. And maybe that's okay. And so for now, I find myself in a post-evangelical, heteronormative, southern white Christianity lifestyle. I'm out of that. And I was booted out of that a while ago for thinking it was totally okay to be gay and thinking that the Nashville statement was bullshit and a bunch of other stuff. But finding myself in just an okay place being adrift. I don't know everything. I don't have to know everything. I haven't totally pitched the baby out with the bathwater and the old way of living, but a lot of it I have, because I just don't think it's the most loving way, and I don't think that it's predicated on truth. I think it's predicated on fear. That's how I'll answer your question.
Cool. That's great. I love it. I'm going to go back and listen to that so many times. That's amazing. Let's see. I don't think I've even asked you any of the things I was going to ask you.
Let me tell you where I didn't expect this interview to go today, and it was there.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Oh, I didn't know what we were going to talk about. I mean, I'm like I said, I don't get uncomfortable at any question. I just had no idea it was going to potentially go there. I'm like, oh, cool. Here it is. Which is funny because I'm talking about that in therapy now.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Therapy was always kind of the boogeyman. And then like I went and was like, oh my God, this is awesome.
Oh, this rules.
I should go. I needed to go at the time I was going. But I've retained a lot of what I learned during that time, and I should probably go again. Yeah.
Oh, babe. Hey. I'm still with Abraham now being interviewed. We just got done crying, been talking a lot about Christianity. Half of that statement is true. We did talk a lot about Christianity, but we're not crying yet. Cool. Well, get on up there, baby. I'll be here. Love you, bye.
Yeah, so I think a lot of the questions that I was thinking about were kind of your thoughts about music locally.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about how you got to the Shoals from Fort Worth.
Yeah.
And why you're still here.
Penny and Sparrow met, we toured around with a band called Grace and Tony. And Grace and Tony became friends of ours originally online and just meeting in that way and liking their music from afar. And then they were willing, at the very beginning of Penny and Sparrow really touring outside of Texas, they were willing to take us on and sort of do us opening for them tour around the South where they had experience and we didn't have any. And so we opened up for Grace and Tony. We became fast friends with them. We love them to death, think that they're fantastic human beings. If you don't know Grace and Tony, they're a husband and wife duo for a long time who did weird metal, bluegrass, folk, bluegrass, fusion, punk, pop, all together. And a lot of it was predicated on their love for horror movies and true crime. And I was immediately enamored with them. I think they're fantastic people. So we opened for them. And the first show we ever opened for them at was in Florence at 116. So we roll up and Jonathan Oliphant was running sound. And right before we play, like somewhere earlier in the day, Tony says, oh, hey, just so you know, my big brother's going to be here tonight. And I think Kyle and I looked at each other like, cool, man. Excited to meet your family. Like, great. But he was like trying to warn us somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just sort of being strange about it. And he's like, well, my brother's John Paul White. And we're like, oh, got it. Check. Which is funny because when Kyle and I sat down at the outset of becoming a band, we were like, hey, let's set out. It would be a pie-in-the-sky dream of ours. And one of the first things we listed were, we want to work with one of three people. We want to work with Sam Beam from Iron and Wine, John Paul White, or we want to work with Glenn Hansard. And so Tony says this, and we're like, that's really funny and weird. But we promise we'll be cool. We won't geek out on him or anything like that. So we play the set to, I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe 15 people, maybe at 116, two of which are John Paul and Jenny. And after the show's over, they come up to us in the green room and are really complimentary, really kind. And we assume, because we're insecure basket cases, Kyle and I, that he's just being kind. That's what you do when the opening band for your brother's band is there. You extend nicety and see you later. So he says at the end of the night, hey, we'd really love to consider doing some co-write stuff if you're interested. And we freaked out. But again, sort of in the back of our mind, assumed. He's like, we'll reach out. We'll call you. Just assuming he was being sweet. Again, like, what a nice thing for him to say. But, you know. It was a phone call we probably won't ever get, which is fine. So we go on the tour. We have a few more shows with Tony and Grace. And then we get that phone call, maybe like a week later, that we got invited to go co-write an album with John Paul at a lake house. It was Will Trapp's folks' lake house. Like, come on out here and we'll do it. So at the time, we were homeless. We didn't have, we just lived on couches or in buddies' places when we could. I wouldn't have a lease or anything. And so we were traveling in two Priuses. my family, me and my wife Sarah and our dog Gator, and Kyle and his wife Becca and their Prius. And so we finish the tour, we drive back to Florence, we co-write this album where we basically, I mean, it comes so fast, like me and Kyle and John sitting on a porch making songs, and it was awesome. The experience was lovely. When we're not writing, we're like touring around Florence and the Shoals, just looking at stuff, seeing stuff, meeting people. When we'd write, Jonathan Oliphant's taking Becca and Sarah around, just showing them stuff. And it started pretty much then. I loved this place. Like, pretty instantly, I loved it. I thought it was great. It felt to me like I'd wanted a place to feel for a long time. And I was already dreading the idea of, like, when we're done, I got to go back to Austin. And I love Austin, but it, I didn't know that I wanted to live in a small town until I all of a sudden found myself living in a small town, because we had rented a house off Hermitage while we were recording in John's studio. And so all four of us are in this house, 528 Hermitage, and we're living there, riding, walking down the street to John's studio, which was that the grandma cottage behind where it is now. And so we're there, falling in love with this place, and we get done with the record and we tour that record, and Sarah and I have this moment where we're like, well, it's time to figure out where to go next. We've finished our time in Florence for work. Like, we're going to be touring this record, sure, but we need a home base. Where we're going to go? And we both wanted to stay. We didn't want to leave. And so we looked into renting a place for a while, and we considered, and we're like, maybe it's time to make the first step to buy our first home. And we bought our first home that we're talking in now 4.5 years ago. Wow. And bought it in Seven Points. It was our first house. Terrifying experience. Lovely. And our family was really confused. And so we started for music, and then we stayed because of the people. Mm. The people and the overall vibe of this place. I would say that was devoid of music, to be honest with you, because, like, had I met people like Reed Watson, Jonathan Oliphant, Olivia, now Oliphant, Allison, now Tillett, like, Will Trapp, the Cartwrights, like, had I met these people devoid of any connection to music or single lock, I would have wanted to be their friend regardless of occupation. As a bonus, that it happened to be like Ben Tanner and Jonathan and all these guys from Single Locker, you know, with a label. But and perfect example, like the record we did after that, it made more sense for us to do it independently, and there was no beef. They were so jazzed that we got to do, like, that I'm still here, I'm still friends with everybody. Like, there's no bad blood or weirdness. Like, they're my friend regardless of this job.
Yeah,
like, they're awesome people. I adore those people.
Yeah,
I still see them from a happy 6 foot distance every week, and I love that. So again, when I say that Sarah and I fell head over heels for this place, I mean it. We bought a home. We didn't know anything about this place other than the people and the fact that we moved here for work.
So did your creative process with Kyle change at that point?
Yeah, totally. But I mean, to be fair, like, the way that we've done it,
it's always been malleable, I guess.
Not only genre-wise, but the way that we've done it. Like, we live in the, one of the excellent things about living in the digital age is that we can, I recorded 90% of the vocals for the last full-length album down the street with Chris Bethay at my sweet, sweet Chris Bethay at Noise Block. And we would just send files back and forth to each other, Kyle and I, from Texas to Alabama, Texas to Alabama, adding stuff, making notes via email, calling each other. I would literally record. It was so great. I would literally do a take, bounce it from Chris's computer to Kyle.
No way.
He'd listen to it. I'd step outside. I'm like, would you dig it? Do you think that was cool? Is it good? Like, he's like, yeah, hey, so listen to the recording on this line. I'd rather have you go up than go down. Like, try this run. And he's like humming the run over the phone. And I'm like, okay, cool. You'll have
almost
the,
real time.
Yeah, you'll have the, it was, you'll have the bounce in 10 minutes. I'll go back inside and do that.
Whoa.
Yeah. And so that we were able to do that. So he, like, life carried them back to Texas to be near their family for a little while because they needed to be. And then Becca got into law school at Baylor. And so she's there, and they live in Waco, and we live in Florence. And I still talk to Kyle every single day of my life.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I thought of something. No, I can't remember what it was.
It'll come back to you.
Yeah, maybe. So... Yeah, I'm really fascinated with your story and how, like, you fit in here. Damn it. What was I going to ask you?
Will.
Oh, yeah. It was some, I think I was thinking about the Postal Service record. Have you ever heard that record?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It made, like, when you said that, I was like, ooh, like the Postal Service.
Yeah.
That's, like, my favorite, like, one of my favorite records of all time, I think.
It's also the only reference point that we had to the fact that it could be done.
Like, are you serious?
Well, yeah.
That's hilarious.
Because Kyle and I, we don't often dig into, like, what was the creative process behind, like, the recording process behind other records. Like, we might look at the writing process or the melodic process or some of the gear and maybe some of the production process. But we didn't know of any other than the, I guess it's Ben Gibbard. Like, we didn't know anybody other than that Postal Service record where they're like, oh, yeah, we make it through the mail. Which is crazy because when that record was made, like,
everything was analog.
Tech was older. I mean, not much, but still was older to where it was like, it was tougher than the time that we're having.
Yeah, like, for sure.
I sing a thing, and in real time, 2.5 minutes later, a version of that with reverb or whatever small production notes we can make on the fly is on my phone, and I can text it to Kyle. Text it to Kyle. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The absurdity of that is outrageous.
So, yeah.
So yeah, we can write from far.
So with that in mind, like, the Shoals as, like, a musical locale, small town, is mostly known for the recording legacy, I suppose.
Yeah.
Like, how do you think that will, like, age? Like, what's it going to look like here in 20 years? Like, do you think that will, like, carry on? Because recording in and of itself has changed. Mm-hmm. Like, how musicians make money has changed. Like, everything's changed.
Yeah.
Since the major legacy of the Shoals area musically was kind of established. So, like, what do you see for this area? Or in general,
yeah,
for the most part, but specifically for here, like, what do you think it'll look like here, like, in the future?
The Shoals already is and can remain a hotbed of creativity and good music being made if people are willing to stay and make music here. And to me, the technological aspects of how easy it's becoming to make music only allow that to happen. Like, it is affordable to live here. You can make albums from your bedroom. There's a huge mixture of people, like a mishmash of music people up and down every single street of this city. And I love that. And the whole Shoals. The thing that would make that, would grease the wheels even further, and when I do see it, it thrills me, is when the old guard leans into the new guard.
Mm. Okay, talk about that a little bit.
John Paul does a great job of this. John Paul doing Single Lock stuff, the guys over at Single Lock inviting new blood, like Space Tiger and like a bunch of Coffee Black. Like, there's a bunch of people that are in and out of Sundrop, their studio, that they're allowing that intermingling of old and new blood. And they have the means to do it because they've got the gear, they've got the cash. And so there are some things that the old guard, if they would but bequeath it to the next gen, it'd be so much easier. And it would, the less separation that you can have from the people on that DVD to the people making music now that are under 25, the less separation you can have, the better. Intermingle. intermingle as much as possible. I think that, if that happens more and more and more, I think it just solidifies the next chapter, the next DVD to get made, like the next set of musicians to come out of this place. Like, it's not that I think that it's necessary for that to happen, but I think that it would make it so much easier. And that's, I know John gets that. And that's why he's like, yeah, young talent, foster young talent, look for young talent.
Yes, I completely agree. But I don't feel like my opinion matters, but I'm really glad to hear you say that.
Yeah, I want to see it more. And I loved it because one of the ways that I saw that early on with us is we were nobody. And them asking to write with us and John Paul opening up the door that way was not only so kind, but when we get to make our record, who did he get to play bass on our record? And who walked in with his bass backpack on and his khaki cargo shorts? But D. Hood. Mm-hmm. David Hood rolls in. I'm like, Jesus Christ, that's David Hood. He's playing bass on this record? Oh, cool. I mean, that's absurd.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So the more that you can get things like that to happen and cross over on both sides and Kimmy playing with Donnie and like all of this is so, so good and done better when crockpotted. Mm-hmm. This place is such a great crockpot of music already. So the more like crossover that you can get, again, a way that John and Single Lock does this really well. Hey, we're throwing a Democratic National Convention thing. You want to come play on it? Hey, we're doing a Christmas deal. You want to come play? You want to come play? You want to come play? Like, it's awesome. It's so great to do more and more and more and more of that. And he doesn't just do that with the Shoals. He does it with Nashville small-time artists and co-writes with those people.
So is that just the formula for no matter where you are? Like, what do you see when you're in Fort Worth or touring or whatever? Like, towns like this or towns like anywhere, I guess. Like, is that just a good philosophy to have? Like, is that possible everywhere? Or do you think that's, like...
I think it's possible everywhere, but I don't think this town exists anywhere else.
Like, the ingredients aren't there everywhere?
Well, I mean, I think good music can be made in Poughkeepsie, can be made in Florence, can be made in Muscle Shoals. Like, good music can be made regardless.
Absolutely.
But I do think that this place, it's like, shit, man, you go to some supermarkets and you don't have all the ingredients to make a really unique, interesting dish. Here, I'm like, Jesus Christ, dude. Look at the fucking smorgasbord of ingredients you have in this place. Mm. Not only history, but new blood, tech, music, fashion, affordability of living. Like, there is so many raw ingredients to throw into the crock pot here that do not exist in other places. Or if they do, it's really expensive to fucking live in Nashville.
Right. So do you think the affordability is like big for you because you get to write all day?
Yeah. Well, I mean, not only that, but the idea of saying the joy of home ownership would not have come to us in Austin. I couldn't afford a brick shithouse in Austin.
Yeah. Like,
but the fact that I can live here with a mortgage that's affordable and the fact that I get a studio and office out of this place. And ultimately, it's not for everybody. Some people make great stuff and they love living in New York and they love living in Nashville. There's no... So you mentioned earlier, like, is that a good rule across the board? I'm like, I don't think there is a rule across the board, but I do think this place is special. This place is unique. There's not another Florence that I know of. There's places that are comparable, but no place is this. And I've gotten to travel a lot for this job and play in a bunch of really small towns at the beginning and then a bunch of the majors now. And I still, like, we could probably find a way to live in any of those cities, and we don't want to. We want to live here. We chose this place. So much more romantic when you choose a thing rather than believing it was somehow star-crossed.
Absolutely. I love that. Yeah. So are all of your lyrics autobiographical, or do you like take liberties with like fiction?
Totally. The latter.
Yeah.
Like not everything. Not. I mentioned that earlier because I feel like there are certain songs that I could lay across to you and be like, oh, this is a really good bookmark for where I was as a man at that time. Here's another one. But some songs are just, that's a love song. That song's about loss. That song's an angry song. That song's because I was pissed off about how people were treating the LGBTQ community, and so I wrote an anthem about that because it sounded like a fun thing to do at the time, and I felt like it needed writing. Like, every album's interspersed with stuff like that. not every single thing is like, well, that's about the time that this happened to me, et cetera. Like, sometimes they're about what happened to my friends, what happened to my family.
Right.
Or just a short story I made up and turned into a song.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome. You're good at expounding on ideas, so I don't have to ask as many questions.
I'm glad.
You know what I mean? Like, I think you went further than a lot of...
I hope it's what you wanted.
No, this is great. Okay, like, cool. I'm just making sure I don't, like, forget something, because all of the... There's, like, so much gold in everything you say. It's awesome.
Oh, thanks, dude.
This is going to be a really long post. I'm glad I don't have to listen to it. I hope that's not part of my job. Okay, so... Oh, yeah. Okay, I just have a couple more questions. We better take pictures.
Yeah, I'm good.
Do you have any, since you're a duo, do you have any advice for, like, collaboration for other people? Or thoughts on collaboration?
Yeah. It's really hard unless you love the other person. I mean that. It's so hard to be creative and for, like, to be creative and the courage to sing a shitty note or to try a shitty lyric out and to not be totally vanquished for the rest of the time. You sit across from certain people and you think to yourself, if I try out this lyric and I judge their micro expression and it communicates to me that they think I'm a dumbass, then it's going to immediately atrophy my desire whatsoever to try something next time.
Right.
I don't have that with Kyle. I have tried some really shit lyrics out on him that I was convinced were good until I thought it through later on. And I've got a relationship with my friend because I love him that is just trusting. Co-writes are hard, man. And I'm not saying great. I know there are so many great songs written by people that didn't know each other before they walked in and just sat down. And maybe it's in their own personal genetic makeup that they're not predisposed to insecurity. But for me, like, if I'm sitting across the table from somebody, like, the more comfortable I can get in my own skin, I feel confident that I'm not going to be looked down on, shamed, embarrassed in front of the other person, I'm so much more free. I can try any number of things. I can, it's like, the freedom that comes from creating stuff with people you love is immensely more valuable to me than that which can be made around people that I don't know.
Mm.
And again, that's not always true with everybody, but for me it is.
Beautiful. Okay, let me ask you one more thing, and then I could probably talk about this for a long time, but we should probably do pictures while there's good light.
Ask what you like.
Oh yeah. What's it been like for you as a creative during, like, during the quarantine? Like, is that something that's, like, inspired you, or, like, seeing societal change, or, like, writing about that, or having different experiences, or seeing society, like, thrown into this, like, chaos, you know? Like, do you think that's been, like, a boon for you, like, creatively, or is it something that's, like, shut you down?
I haven't dived into writing about COVID or writing about what quarantine life has been like. I've intentionally not. I think mostly because... I don't know, that specific avenue hasn't been one that I've wanted, hadn't interested me. It hasn't interested me yet. Like, maybe it will, but right now it hasn't. Like, what hasn't interested me is, like, the stuff that I'm reading, like, the stuff that the words that I'm learning about. I'm usually reading two or three things at a time and listening to something else, and that's been what's inspired me. Like, for me, a lot of people were massively affected in terms of their day-to-day routine by this quarantine and this outbreak. And I wasn't massively affected in terms of, like, my social routine. Like, it meant that I couldn't go to the YMCA anymore. And it meant that I can't go inside of Rivertown. I have to wait outside to get my coffee. And the thing that it really took from me that I mourned the most is people. Like, there's a well of stuff I could probably write about that, but the only main thing that it's really cost me now is touch. I'm an extremely physically affectionate person, like, very huggy, how I am, and so the removal of that has been, that's been tough. That's affected me. But for the most part, 90% of my workday has been inside my brain. And I just park my brain in this chair or that chair or the chair outside. And I ruminate on words and just try and put them together in a way that I find beautiful and that I find impressive. And then I hope that other people will eventually when I sing them. So, like, yes, this has affected, like, it's added worry, it's added stress, it makes me worry for my parents, it makes me worry for my immunocompromised friends in town, it makes me think that certain people are assholes because they're not considerate of other people that are in those situations, like, all that stuff. But creatively, it slowed everything down, which I've found to be one of the only pleasant things about this era. It's like everybody's on Mayberry time.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they want it to be or not. For some people, they're railing against it. They're fucking furious that they've had to slow down. And me, I'm like, I like it.
I kind of like it too.
Yeah, no, and what I'm not saying is the same thing you're not saying. I'm not jazzed that this befell us. Yeah. But if I'm a hunter of silver linings, this one wasn't a difficult one to find, which is... the clock slow. I like the clock slow.
Cool.
Yeah.
Is this what you want to do for the rest of your life, you think?
I want to do this and a bunch of other things.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, I want to do music forever. I want to do music until the chords stop working. it's like until you figure out that you can't. Well, you know, like a pitcher eventually is like, oh, I can't throw in the 90s anymore.
Uh-huh.
So one of two things happens. He retires. Or he learns how to throw a knuckleball. Tim Wakefield pitched until he was in his late 40s. So I'm like, shit, man. If I can figure out how to throw a knuckleball, I'll probably always pitch.
Yeah.
If I can figure out what the equivalent of that is in music, then okay. I'll just try and always do music somehow.
That's cool.
Which would be awesome. But I want to write books. I want to win a Bram Stoker Award so bad it hurts me sometimes. there's 1,000 things I want to do. But all of them involve words.
Nice. Well, man, thanks.
Yeah, dude.
That was awesome.
I hope so. I get the great news about not knowing what you want. It was like, I just will talk and we'll see if you dig it.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool.